Welcome to the Talking Gardens podcast with me, Stephanie Mahon. This time, I'm very excited to be talking with the celebrated Dutch planting designer, Piet Adolf, best known for creating transformative public planting schemes such as the Lurie Garden in Chicago, the High Line in New York, the Olympic Park in London, and Houser and Worth in Somerset. I started by asking Piet to describe his dream garden.
My dream gardens are the gardens I probably try to make when I'm working with a client on a new project. But a dream garden is, of course, if you're inspired by all the nature and beauty of nature around you, that is what you try to achieve. But you, at the same time, you know you never can do that. You will never achieve what your sort of fantasy pushes you to. The complexity of a dream garden is too high, I think, to ever achieve it. And you have to be fair to yourself that you never can do that. You know, the gardens I do are satisfying and very satisfying at certain points when we have people that take good care of them. But that's more or less the limit of what one can do.
And what is in the gap between what you imagine in your head and what ends up being the reality? Could you sort of say, how different is it, or how far away is that dream that you initially come up with compared to what you end up achieving?
Yeah, to be honest, I'm a very realistic person. So everything that I do seems to work out in the way I have it in mind. Different sometimes more beautiful. Not so much disappointments after so many years of working. So the fact is that what I do is a lot of thinking, a lot of things putting together before you can start doing it. And so the whole process takes sometimes weeks from beginning till the end by making a planting design or a garden design. And there's so many things in between that you have meetings that, you know, what you have in mind is just a big idea when you start. And when you're finished, the idea, you hope that the idea is still what you had in mind in the beginning. So in between the beginning and the end, there's a big gap of just working and just try to make it realize on paper.
We sort of get a good insight into your working processes in your new book, Piet Adolf at Work. How was that, making that book? Because for people who don't know, it's not written by you. It's written about you by some of your friends and associates and people that you've worked with over the years. How was that experience compared to your other books of having all of these people write essays about you and talk about your work over the years?
You know that the books we have made from the beginning, you know, in the early 90s, with Henk Gerritsen, the book Dream Plants, later called Dream Plants for the Natural Garden. I think that was the beginning of all the writing, but I never wrote one thing in any book we did. So it was always collaborating with someone that knew my work, could translate my work, or a corporate book with Noel about, you know, designing with plants and...
Noel Kingsbury.
So I learned to cooperate with people, and that worked out very well. We have made more than 10 books altogether. And this book was just because I've done so many gardens over all these years, and I started completely different, but very different by never making a planting plan. And that started to happen when I worked on bigger scale projects that I had to do something on paper. And then I started to train myself to put my planting plans on paper. Also, I started to learn myself how to calculate the numbers of plants, you know, the spacing of plants and all these things over the years that made that I could keep my work as a document instead of just having lists of plants that you would throw away after making the garden and then follow up with the gardeners what to do. So I had so many drawings. And in the beginning of the pandemic, I just started to scan them in. I have a professional scanner, and there were more than 1,000 drawings and sketches, 1,500, I think, altogether. So what I did, what I thought, that I should do something with it. I had the idea roughly already in my head, but now I had them on, you know, my computer, in my files, on a very good resolution, so I could do something with him. And then Fidon, I think there were more people at that moment that wanted to make a book. They, you know, sometimes ask you, do you have a new idea or do you have this or that? I said, yes, I would love to make a book about my design, a sort of artistic book, more artistic. And I had, first I had in mind only to do drawings and not many text. And then we, at the end, with the designer of Fiden, they created a sort of first concept of how the book could be laid out. And then they came up with just pictures of gardens and just the essays. And so it came to a point that it was not just about the drawings, but it was just more. It was just showing the gardens, showing the drawings, showing the whole process. And that worked out very well, I think, at least when you see the book now, you think it works out better than probably just drawings.
Yeah, your planting plans are quite well known, and you've even had exhibitions of them in different places, haven't you? Because they're so extraordinary with all of their different colours and very unique to you how you do them. A lot of other designers, they don't like to share their planting plans. They're afraid that people will copy what they do, but you don't seem to mind sharing.
Yeah, what is the problem, you know? I think by sharing, because all my life I shared, you know, whether people came to my house, I had one plant, I could dig it up and gave them the a part of it, or that always have. That's how I am. And sharing is what I thought, also showing people how you do it makes it also feel that you can teach some people of the ideas. And if you look at restaurants and chefs, they share all their recipes. You know, if you look in their books, every big meal, whatever famous meal, is just split up in all these little ingredients, and they tell you how to do it, and still people cannot do it.
Yes, true, isn't it? Yeah, just because you have those ingredients doesn't mean you can do what some Michelin
star chef does. No, it doesn't say that you can cook.
Well, speaking of chefs, one of the projects in the book and one of your more recent projects is the famous Noma in Copenhagen. How was that project? I know that they've changed how they're doing things there from sort of a fine dining restaurant to something a little bit more experimental, that they're moving into a new phase in what they're doing.
No, that's still a sort of very fine dining restaurant, but I think they stopped doing that frequently. They opened the restaurant, I think, if I'm right, by time. And at the rest, they started a testing restaurant at Noma, and they are going to sell products, I think, also. So they test, they make things from the restaurant that you can buy or other restaurants can buy. I think that is roughly what they are going to do. But at the moment, they are just in Kyoto. They're there for 3 months altogether, I think. And that, yeah, that's fine dining every night. So it's hard to say, but it's a very complex thing to keep 100 people work, you know, on the payroll, and then doing something simple that is not easy.
Was it fun to sort of collaborate with, you know, a chef or, you know, a group of restaurant people, food people?
Yeah, it was very easy. They came to Hamelo, we showed them the garden, we talked a little bit. They loved what I did and what I do. They were talking about a garden with plants that you could use for, you know, for the kitchen or for the restaurant. But I thought that is hardly impossible because a lot of them are herbs, not attractive. And so most of the perennials are not really for cooking. Yeah? But I said we could do in that the garden is split up in you know, three areas, a kind of small woodland, a parking lot area, and then a long stretch towards the end, which is split up in a small area near the testing kitchen where they can do what they like. So we have a little concept every year of what to do, and they can fill it in with things they like or they want. They can add anything they want. And we do that together with the gardener. I think the garden will stay. So it's not that the restaurant stops and the garden will stop. No, the garden will go on because it's an important place for them to do the testing. But I think that is, yeah, how it goes. So I felt a sort of freedom, very free, yeah, because there's no, I don't get any comment on what I do. So only questions what to do or questions, can we add something like this? And, you know, that's a normal process.
Collaboration, you do seem to, you talked about it for the book and obviously when you're working with other creative people for something like Noma and they're being experimental. Do you enjoy that process of collaboration with other people on your projects around the world? I believe you sort of have team members, you know, that you use for different projects in different places.
No, I work on my own, and all the people I work with are independent garden designers or plant specialists. Or I work, for instance, when I'm in the US, I work with a landscape architect who take care of all the, documents and all the necessary paperwork. And also he communicates with the client, and I work under him on the project. And so that's how we communicate, have a network of 3-4 people in America that I really know how I work and how to implement a garden from my drawings. I think that is important, but that took me many years to discover those people, because some of them learned from me how to do it. And I think that's why they are very thankful and want to help me when I'm over there.
Do you develop a shorthand with them? Is it easier to communicate now that you've worked, you know, when you've worked together on a few projects and you've sort of...
Yeah, I can just mail them and say, it's a new project offered. Can you help me out with, the planting or something? If I need a landscape architect, I can call him and say, new project, can you take care of all the necessary technical issues and communicate with the client if I'm not there? And that's how it happens. So it is easier, but the danger is that you can take on too much work, because there's so many sort of people that join in that it feels so easy sometimes that you forget that there's for yourself just a limited part of time.
Yeah. How do you decide what you're going to say yes to? What makes a project worth taking on for you?
Yeah, it often is the person, how people approach you. So if they're nice, I can just... when it feels good on the telephone, you say, send me an email with what you think is you want me to do. And then from there out, we start to communicate. If I think it's too big or in my age, I think sometimes it takes too long. It's just at the start of everything, and it can take 10 years before it's finished. So those are the projects you don't do anymore. But I try to find out the quality of the project, also not as necessarily where it is, but more the people around it and what they, the enthusiasm and also the logistics. So I can see sometimes that it's in the middle of a country where I think, okay, how can we get the plants? And then I see all the problems that can come up, which the client doesn't see. They have a gardener, but a gardener is not enough. You need to be able to provide the plants and people to set out the plants. And so the whole organization should be right. And I think people forget about that. I can do that, but not everywhere.
Well, you talk about the difficulty of getting plants. I know that one of the reasons I believe that you even started with what you do now way, way back in the day is because you found it difficult for the projects that you were working on, that you were landscaping, to find the plants that you really loved, that you thought would work. And you set up your own nursery to grow those plants. But now that you've closed your nursery, where do you find the plants that you're growing? Do you have people growing specific things for you? Do you still get excited about finding new plants that are being bred or being grown in different places?
That we started a nursery, and Anya, my wife, is very important in the whole process, because she took care of all the public relationships. She was selling the plants, and I could, in the meantime, she was just doing the sort of communication with the clients on the nursery. I was often in the office, just being busy with my work, design work, or traveling. So that was, in the beginning, the idea was just to grow plants for my projects. But the first 5-6 years, I had no projects. So it all started with the nursery to become well known by the kind of plants we were growing and introducing, and also breeding. At that time, it was so much time here in the nursery, and to do that. And my traveling was, most of my, my friends lived in England, because that was where, the sort of, where it all happened for me, and it's all where I got so many friends that it was easy to get the plants that we were not having here in the Netherlands. So it was sort of, and on the other hand, we traveled to Europe and Germany and Scandinavia, and we found plants that, we also didn't have in the Netherlands, but people from England found them interesting. So we became a sort of international hub for people that love plants. And organizing these plants days in the 80s made it also, and inviting nurserymen from all over the Netherlands made it, you know, that our nursery was the thing. You know, it was not about me and my design work. It was all about that nurseryman that also did some design work. You know, but the meaning was that I was, as a designer, started the nursery to have the right plants. But that's a long story short. It all worked out. So after 6-7 years, we got really design work, and Anya did the nursery, and I could travel. And yeah, the variety of plants was important for me, because if you travel and you love plants and gardens, everywhere you come, you see something that nobody sells. Because you visit people that love plants, that collect them from places where you haven't been and will never be your whole life. And so you want to take them home and produce them. And so we did that. But when we stopped, when we decided to stop, I had to find people that could produce them. And I had this relationship with Future Plants for many years, Future Plants that produces plants mainly for wholesale, or just sending them over to America. And so they were very helpful in the beginning when I started to work in the US on gardens, that they could send over plants that they didn't have in the US. So I could, through them, I could find wholesale growers in the US that could provide me with plants or grow plants for that first American garden in Chicago.
The Lurie Garden.
The Lurie Garden. So that, and you can see so many things happened. That, and then at that time in America, there was, you know, the growers didn't grow much. You know, they bought wholesale plants from bulk growers that also sold perennials. So the main assortment and main variety of plants were hostas and astilbes and hemerocallis and maybe Veronica, and that was that. So, but that changed very much and very fast from the year 2000 and onwards. They started also to produce themselves, to breed plants. And so now there's sort of equal, like in the Netherlands, and sometimes even more. So today there's no problem to get the plants that you like. Of course you have sometimes, because it's in your system to find things that you know that not everyone grows. To put them on your drawing because you think, if I'm lucky, I can find them somewhere. And that happens. So I'm very aware of what is not available, but sometimes I try it because I know there's some people or small companies that we can find them. So that is America. So that works very well. And in the Netherlands, we with Future Plants and other big nurseries, we could, you know, we can more or less find what we need. There could be a problem that things are sold out. Things are just sold just before they, you know, sometimes you order in advance, but then at the end they say, okay, this didn't work out. And, you know, for one or other reason that is not there anymore. And, you know, it's always not problematic, but there's always little problems of what at the end is not there, what you ordered.
Even at your level, you have to deal with sometimes the plants that you want not being available. That will make a lot of designers listening feel a lot better.
Yeah, the good thing is we stick to a few people that we order plants to. So they can collect it from other growers so that it all comes together. So that makes it less complicated at the end. But it could be complicated because other growers promise the grower we use that they have it, and sometimes not. But I have the problem that everyone has. It has nothing to do with me, but with the, you know, the complexity of the market.
And do you still find new plants that you haven't come across before, you know, in people's gardens or nurseries, and then get excited and bring it home and grow it to see how it is? Or is it different for you? Is it more that you can hear about a new cultivar that's come out and kind of understand that maybe you would want to use it in your scheme? Or do you still get excited when you see something in someone's garden that you've never come across before?
I can become excited. But, you know, the other thing is that every plant you like wouldn't be a plant that people will grow, because it can be a sort of too delicate, you know, and it could be too complicated to grow. So, and of course, I buy plants and plant them in my garden and see what they do. And if I like them, I see if there are someone grows them, or if future plants can grow them on for or anyone else that I know. But that, I try to stick to the variety I know, and there's, I find new plants, but it takes 3, 4, 5 years sometimes to get a new plant into the market, on a, even on a smaller scale. There's hardly any plant that they produce and say, oh, next year we have 10,000. Or, I can give you an example of this new Schizogerium, that little blue stem from Cassian Smith, that we found years and years ago in the Weinheim garden in Germany.
In the Hermannshof,
not Hessen, Hermannshof.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was, I saw it for 1 or 2 years, and I was there with Cassian. I said, now we should make a decision. And so we picked one out, and I got a piece, but still, that it's still just on the market. And if I look back, it's 8 years ago, 9 years ago that we made a decision. So, and now there's quantities, because you start with 1 or 3 and then people love it, and then someone start to grow it, and then it's sold out because everyone likes it, and it's now in America. And I think that's the first delivery, or real delivery, is this year. So those are problems with new plants that you really know that you can use in public space, or in your design, or in any design you, because also the plants have to be durable. They have to be sort of resilient. They have to be strong, especially when you work in public space. You know, private gardens are easier, because if a plant fails, it falls out, they can buy a new one. But you can imagine if people call me from a big public space that you can't come over to see what goes wrong, and what, you know, and what to replace on that scale. So you have to trust your plants, and if it goes wrong, you know what, you probably can estimate what is going wrong. You can decide whether you plant it or plant something else. That is, you communicate with the gardener, with the people that take care on the other hand, and find out what to do. But with private people, they love gardens, but the communication about what to do when things go wrong, that is different.
You do, of course, do private gardens as well as, you know, public parks and public realm projects. You have said to me previously that you really love the public realm projects because, you know, you're communicating to so many people. Is that why you prefer those larger scale projects that you seem to be doing these days? Or do you still do private gardens now?
No, I can imagine that, you know, I started with just 96 with my first public garden in Sweden, in Enköping. That garden became an example for many gardeners or many cities in Sweden. So that is the difference between private and public. And not only for myself, for me, it was a big experience, because so many things went wrong, that because we had a good understanding with the director of parks, we could easily, you know, may make it work again. On the other hand, and what I mean to say is, so public make people aware, but also aware of what you do. If I have kept my work within four walls with a private garden, I wouldn't have been sitting here with you probably with the book I have, because it limits you a lot also. And I know in the beginning when I came up, people said, Pete, are there any new gardens we can just publish? I said, yes, I have this garden here, for instance, Highline. No, public gardens. People love private gardens. You know, we don't do public gardens. And nowadays it's sort of more.
It flipped the other way around.
It's the other way around. Yeah. So by doing it, it turns around people's vision on gardens too, you know, and what they... But for me, it is this sort of also one way you get recognition on a larger scale, because in private, yeah, it's always good, you know, people love your work. It's but in public, if it goes wrong, people will tell you. If it, you know, people call you, not call you, but let the know that you did something wrong, or it doesn't look good, you know, the high line. Oh, we were in the high line and, you know, a little bit behind with maintenance, something like that. Yeah, you know, I can't help that, you know. And then the next one, a week later, says, oh, it looks terrific, so beautiful, you know. You can't predict what people say about your work, but at least I know that, you know, the start is good, and it all depends on the stewardship of people that take care of it.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the High Line, and I think it's 20 years since the Ideas competition that first sort of started everything.
2004 was the first meeting with me and field operation,
I mean, it's been quite a long-range project, as well as becoming so famous. I think it was 2019 that the spur, the last sort of section,
was done.
And then that's like woodland planting style, which I think most people wouldn't associate with you as a woodland style. How has it been sort of from the very beginning, 20 years watching the project grow and change? I mean, it's quite unique in that way, isn't it? In that it's been running for such a long time, and it's that really famous public project. I'm just wondering what your feelings are about the first phases that happened, and how things have changed over time.
Yeah, I felt more easy with it, you know, that in the beginning you feel, there's so many plants that so many things are happening during the installation and the big work, you know, in a big city. And then I come over to oversee the planting and so on. It's overwhelming sometimes when you look back how much you've done without thinking. Because I didn't thought about it, just thought I'm going to do it. And if we had there were meetings to say, oh, we probably doubt about this, or do you think this birches will grow there? And I had to convince people that they would grow there, even though afterwards, when I went back home or so, I thought, yeah, will they grow there? So we have to, people make you doubt a lot, you know, by all their questions. Well, you think you do well, from out of your experience, you do so many things. And of course, you don't do it always right, but you get so many questions about why you do it and why you do it, and will it be a success? And if you work on the High Line, which is so big, and you say yes, you have to, if you say no, you can't say no, you have to say it will work, and then you see it works, that is a big achievement, also a big reward for yourself. But you can see how complicated it is, you know, that millions of people can judge you.
Yeah. And of course, another project that you did 20 years ago was the planting of the glasshouse borders at Wisley. And of course, it's been announced now that you are going to be revisiting that and changing it and doing a whole new planting in that area, I believe, sort of over this autumn, winter and into next year, if they can move a colony of Roman snails in time. I think there's a slight delay, isn't there, with the planting. Is that fascinating for you? Is that interesting for you to go back and redo a whole section like that, to make a whole new landscape there?
Yeah, I think people were so happy with it, you know, but it looked a little bit tired and sort of uncontrollable in my eye and many people's eye, I think. But it's nice to make something. I love Wisley and the people there. And also I meet friends that, you know, that come over to Wisley. You know, so many people love to go there, and so many people I know there, that it is hard to say no if they ask you to do another design for the borders. And I think I was waiting for it for many years, and you see there was still in between a lot of delay, because I think the question, if I could do it, was maybe 5 years ago. And now we're starting. So, but I think I love the new idea of just people start from the hill or from the bottom and going through the garden meandering and just see different kind of planting types, not styles, one style, three different sort of planting ideas while they walk. And then we try to fill it up in the background with beautiful shrubs, a lot of North American shrubs and little trees, and just to make it, I think better. When they came, you know, in the year 2000, when we started, it was just to create a parallel borders to the double borders we have. So it was really focusing on the glasshouse. And people ask me often, why did you do this straight line, you know, which is
Yeah, it's not like you to do two borders with a path down the middle.
But that was what they asked me to do, you know, just two parallel borders in a style, in my style. And I can imagine in the year 2000 that, yeah, my style has developed in more more complexity than at that time. So that was also a reason that I would love to show what we do nowadays, you know, in these bigger mountings.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in how you would describe the difference between that planting, that, you know, that style that you had then, and what the difference is with what you do now.
Yeah, I wasn't, you know the term matrix planting, where a few plants dominate the planting, where other plants emerge from, other plants that go up out of that planting, that makes it more, feel more natural. What I did at that time was just putting combinations together that followed up through the seasons. In that border in Wisley, we had a combination of four plants, where the one flowered in June, the other maybe in the summer, and one in the fall. So it was a different approach of still with a four seasonal interest, but it was less complex. It was mainly a group planting, or in that sense, they were more diagonal rivers, so four combinations and then repeating over that whole length. So the big difference is that the layering nowadays, more layering, so more intermingling of plants or matrix plantings, or that intermingling, that is group planting, but two combinations of one good variety. I would say echinacea, and then underneath we plant calamintha, or we let gum out veronica or veronicastum out of those groups. And I think that is more complex. I feel that myself, it's more complex to put it on paper, to make it clear for people how to work it out. And that's good to have people nowadays that work with me on my plantings. They understand it and how to do it in the following order. You can see that in the book as well, where at Vitra, how we explain how we set out the planting and the following order. And I think that is... But the complexity is what happens. So complexity, and which makes it more intense sometimes, more different, and more natural, more wild. I could say wild. Yeah.
Yeah, slightly more naturalistic feel rather than, let's say, what was known as that new perennials movement at the beginning.
But we cannot just go, because people say, "Oh, you still do this block planting." And the block planting is a sort of traditional way of putting plants together in a nice combination. And that works out over in the garden as simple. First, I would say block planting is necessary for people that don't understand the sort of matrix planting. Matrix planting needs more knowledge, about the process of how plants develop, how they behave towards each other, how they can, and people with not enough knowledge, they lose control. They don't know whether this plant should really be there. Is it allowed to seed out a little bit? And I say with this so-called simple group plantings or block planting, as you say, makes that people can reconstruct it, bring it back to what it was. And that's why I still do it. I still do it in public space where you know that the gardeners are not really sort of have the depth of knowledge. So all my movements in gardens are related with... Who's going to take care? Where am I doing it? That's why I'm lucky to do it in places like Wisley, where you know the knowledge is great. I do it in Petra. We have to teach people, say that we need a gardener, because otherwise you lose the intent and you lose, could look good, but in 10, 5 years' time you think, oh God, we cannot, what to do? And I think that's, we're lucky with the Lurie Garden in Chicago with the great staff. With Detroit, great interest to learn, a lot of volunteers. Volunteers are important because they can learn, they love to work, they socialize. Of course, volunteers is a matter of socializing with each other and talk about plants and gardens. So you help a lot of people that probably have no garden and just are very into, or had a garden in the past, but are older now and just want to do some garden work. And we benefit of that in our public space as well. So we have, I think many gardens couldn't exist without volunteers.
I think that's definitely, you know, two things that we hear about a lot are both that design projects and planting, especially complex planting, like you were talking about, that designers often feel, you know, that there really isn't the knowledge base there. It's very difficult to find really good gardeners to maintain or have aftercare, look after the projects once it's been planted and completed. I don't think as many people are as positive about volunteers as you just were, but they definitely are the lifeblood of an awful lot of gardens, aren't they, and public spaces. Those people who give their time for free and are really invested. One place that another project that you're going to be working on here in the UK, which is definitely going to have a lot of volunteers and has a lot of community support behind it, is the Camden High Line. What's the situation with that at the moment? I think a lot of people have been waiting a long time for that to get off the ground.
I think it's a matter of financing. I think there's a green light to start, but I think it's all about the budget and money. I think that's what happens. And I think that, that's the moment now. But there's a green light, and so it will happen one day. I hope I will be there.
Yeah, you've walked the line, I believe, and been asked to work on it. Is that correct?
Yeah. It would be beautiful to do something, but I think there's a lot of structural work to be done. There's a lot of definition to be done, you know, exactly what to do. So my work will start when that is sorted out, more or less. And I can start working on a planting design, but if things are not fully designed, you know, in the design phase, the final design phase, then you can't do anything.
And should people expect, do you think, to have the New York High Line just in London, or would you do something slightly different this time?
No, I do what I do. I can't do anything else, but, you know... As you know, sometimes it's more woodland, sometimes more perennial, sometimes third. But there's a lot of, housing along it, you know, where people live. And so there's so I think there will be communicated with the people that live there as well, more than at the High Line. I think it's more, and the High Line, you know, that after it was done, it gentrified, the whole area gentrified. And I think you cannot just change Camden so much anymore. So I think that it's a different context, different. I think that makes it already, if your work will seem different if they walk that. It doesn't have that sort of big impact as the High Line, I think. There's still a train running, you know, along that park. So.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That's interesting. Well, that's certainly going to make it difficult for planting decisions, right?
Sometimes, yeah. It's very narrow, but it's narrow, so... Sometimes wider, but we'll see. I have an idea, but I don't know what to do. You know, I'm not really know what will happen.
And I mean, you've traveled the world now, and you've seen so many places. And I know you're just as interested in landscapes as you are in gardens. But is there anywhere left that you feel you still really want to see that you haven't been to yet? Is there a landscape that you would still love to see, or a place that you'd love to visit that you haven't managed to make it to?
No, not really. I have seen many places. I think you could say, okay, I would love to see Nepal. I would love to see... I've seen North America several times. We traveled through on holidays. I love North America. I love North America. I would love Scandinavia. I love the northern countries, you know, our sort of... I'm not... of South America. I would love to go to Chile or, you know, that, or Argentina, just to see it. I think that is, I would love to see. I haven't been there, but Scandinavia, I've been there many, many times. And so China, I've been there with the group, with Tom Short-Smith and other people, Kassian and James Hitchmo. So I've seen a little bit of China. And I think we are now busy in Korea with creating a big park, a big public space. I love it because the people are so, you know, they do so much to make it happen. During my life, I see that I never wished something. It just happened. That is a point. I never had the time to think about, I would love to do this, I would love to do that. And the only thing I thought about, I want to have a little bit more space or room or time. Between my work, and that is the only thing I long for, that I have more freedom in, you know, within my work, more space, more, you can take more time to see your own work. I think that is, And that happens more or less now, that I take on lesser work. I try to stop my work over the oceans. So in America, I have still a project to go, you know, the Calder Foundation, Calder Gardens in Philadelphia. I go to Chicago next month in June to assess, do an assessment, go to Detroit. So I love to see back the gardens I've done, but I try to do it a little bit less than I did in the past.
And I mean, I know something else is you closed the nursery, but a few years ago, you also closed your garden to visitors. Visitors had been flocking to see your garden there at your home. How has that been? Has it been lovely to reclaim your space, your garden for yourself and just enjoy being there gardening for you again?
It feels better because you don't have an agenda. And I know that if your garden is open from Thursday to Saturday, you cannot do anything else. Anya always had to be here, and since we closed, we still kept it open for groups, so still had a busy agenda and had to stay home. And I think that's stopped now. So we say, okay, we don't make appointments anymore. That people say we will come in August. Can we see the garden? Say no. Call me when you're in Holland, and we'll see whether we are at home or not. That is the only possibility, because in the meantime, we have so many good gardens in the Netherlands, the Vlinderhof, we have Singer, we have two museum gardens here. Just over the border here in Germany, we have this big Maximilian Park, which looks very good. And that's that must be enough. Our garden, still garden it, but in a more simpler way. We try to do that too. But people are not disappointed if they come, but we don't want to emphasize on our garden anymore as we did in the past.
And you have an Instagram account now where you people can see, you know, it changing through the year because you post such beautiful images of things that are happening there. Is that something you've taken to social media? Is it nice to share in that way?
Yeah, I love to share, but it is just Instagram, because you see you get a lot of reactions, and I think it's sometimes you get a reaction, let's say 10,000, 14,000 on a picture you didn't realize that people would love it, and other pictures you love yourself, you get only 1,800 or so. It is strange to see what people like and not like. But you also notice that there's a lot of followers that are not really followers. They only follow you because you have so many followers.
I see.
Part of that that's also true, you know. I like it, and I'm very easy, you know, for Instagram. It's just posting is just a simple thing. And then to see how other people react on that is also nice, you know.
Is there anything that you feel you still have to do, you still have to prove, you know, is there a project that you would get really excited about or would love to do, a sort of fantasy project of something?
Yeah, you talk about fantasy
wanted
all the time, but I haven't.
Yeah, so it's the format of the podcast, yeah, usually, is that we ask people about their dream gardens. But
I say the proof is in the pudding, huh?
Is that right?
That is my work. It's the fantasy is just something imaginary that you cannot explain. And I think I never had during my life, everything just came into me, that dreaming about things before, there was never time for. It all came on my path. And then you start dreaming into what you could do for that particular project. But although you're podcast is about imaginary projects.
I think it's about the best of things and what you think, you know, the most wonderful plants and places are, that maybe people would love to know what you think, you know, really good examples of places that they should go and see, or people that they should know about, or planting that they should consider.
Oh, yeah. So. Yeah, of course, I think just landscapes are for me the most important thing. And gardens, you know, we know all the famous gardens in England and then every place you go. But I think I would love to see more public space, that people could see what is done there. So I think Tom Stuart Smith is doing a lot of public space nowadays. And I think many others in our field. That's important for people to learn, I think. It is also the biggest challenge for us to create something that people will see as just improving making the world a better thing, huh? and creating more diversity in our space. I think that is, for me, always has been a goal, you know, to show people what you could do. And that may be my dream, you know, to show people what they could do for themselves and also to create a nicer world in the city or any place where people go to. I think that is maybe a dream that I never thought of, you know, never think of, but in fact is what I try to do.
That was Pete Adolf talking to me, Stephanie Mahon, on Talking Gardens, brought to you by the team behind Gardens Illustrated magazine. Discover the new book, Pete Adolf at Work, published by Fiden, out now. And look out for news about the new plantings at RHS Garden Wisley at gardensillustrated.com. Hit follow now to make sure you don't miss an episode.